The topic for today is stages of development in integral recovery. And just want to give you a quick overview of where we'll go for the next hour and kind of the format. I've already kind of tipped my hand. What I want to do is present some material. I've got three or four basic chunks. I'm going to give kind of a quick kind of personal history with developmental theory, just to kind of root this in personal experience, and invite you to join me in it. And you'll see that I'll invite your reflections on that. And then after that, that'll be 10-15 minutes. And then I want to discuss just for a few minutes some basic foundations of developmental stage theory, which sounds really boring, but it doesn't need to be. And as we talk about it, it'll make more sense before we actually dive into the specific developmental stages. And I'll pause. I'll present material for 10 minutes or so, maybe at a time, for the sake of this recording, but I'll pause so that you and I can dialogue, because I really want you to be involved in this. And questions or comments, reflections, I feel like it's part of the lecture. So we will get to talking about developmental stages in the second half of the presentation for another chunk. And then I want to close up by looking at some practical applications of all of this material to integral recovery. So that's kind of the overview of where we'll be going. And as I say, we'll be breaking it up. I'll be breaking it up by checking in with you. And I think that's why I was checking with the instant messaging. If you've got a question or something comes up, it's just you and me. So just say, hey, Bob.
Okay.
I'd like it to be, I've evolved towards this over the years to what I call lecture dialogues, where there is material, but it's really meant to be also in a spirit of dialogue. So please know that that's my wish here. So.
Okay.
All right. So let's dive in. Just by way of introduction, let me quote, there's a social psychologist. He's actually kind of seen as the father of social psychology in some ways. His name is Kurt Lewin. And he said this. He said, there's nothing so practical as a good theory. That's always stayed with me. There's nothing so practical as a good theory. And as I was preparing for this material, Hamlet, I was thinking of theories that have had a big impact on me across my lifetime. You know, I actually thought of them as kind of game-changing ideas. And we'll be talking about one of them today, talking about developmental theory of stages. Let me give you a handful of examples and ask as I'm sharing all of this, for you to be kind of reflecting on your own experience for sure, and we'll be tapping into that. These are ideas that really led to paradigm shifts in my life. It wasn't just an intellectual thing, it was like a life thing. Very early on, about 40 years ago or so, I was studying psychology and religion in the undergraduate. Went to school in Fresno here in Central California. And I had an opportunity to start reading the Danish theologian and philosopher Kierkegaard. And it was the first time I had been pretty involved in conservative Christianity for a handful of years. I didn't grow up in that, but I got very involved in that. And my first encounter with Kierkegaard, here was somebody who talked about spirituality, not in terms of dogma, but in terms of experience. He was kind of one of the founding fathers of existential philosophy, and he was interested in our inner experience of spirituality or of faith, and that had a huge impact on me, and it matched something that was opening for me. So that's an example of one of these theories that was very practical, really led to some change for me. Another one for me, some years later in graduate school, was my encountering the typology that had been developed by Carl Jung, that fleshed itself out in the Myers-Briggs typology. You're probably familiar with that, but that was another one for me that had a big impact on my relationships, particularly my understanding of my marriage at that time. It was like reading material and having kind of an epiphany reading it. And really took hold. And more recently for me, in my own process of recovery, I found reading some Buddhist texts on what they call precepts, moral precepts, how these were significant for me was this is the first time that I read and had ears to hear why sobriety might truly be desirable in my life. It was another one of those kind of the timing was right to encounter this material, and it's really had a really positive impact for me. Before I go any further, have you experienced this where you've come across an idea or a theory and just kind of had your life turn on a pivot point, you know?
Yeah, all the time. I'm not sure if it's theories, but I mean, I'll come across something that I'm reading, and it, you know, I've had experiences where I feel like the room has been alive with some presence.
Yeah.
Like there has been something inside that space, and I'm like, wow, and my whole face is just lit up because what I'm reading has been made so much sense at the moment, or has been so profound. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. That's good. That's exactly, you just named it. It's pretty incredible when the words leap off a printed page, whatever it is you're reading, or if you're watching something, whatever, and you're not the same after you read it. You know, it really changes something fundamental. Well, I'll tell you, developmental theory was like that for me, and probably wouldn't strike most people as that. Maybe it would. I don't know. But I want to tell you a quick story by way of introduction. Mm-hmm. It was 1980. I was starting my second year of graduate school. I was going to a conservative Christian seminary here in Southern California, and I took a class that was called Ecology of Faith Development. And our central textbook for that class had just been written. It was written by a man named James Fowler. At that point, he was teaching in Georgia, at the University of Georgia, if I'm not mistaken. And he developed a book. The book was called Stages of Faith. And he developed a stage theory looking at the development of spirituality. It turns out that Ken Wilber picked up on this almost immediately. And so I began reading about it in Ken Wilber, too. I had been exposed to Ken Wilber a little bit earlier. But in this class, we weren't reading Wilber. We were reading Fowler. And I don't know how much background you have in developmental ideas or psychology. Certainly, you know, Ken Wilber is rooted in developmental theory. But in my undergraduate studies, I had studied cognitive development. Especially the big name there was the Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget. Does he ring a bell? Do you know?
No? Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to assume one way or the other. Okay. Yeah. And had a course where I studied him in detail, and also studied Lawrence Kohlberg, who was kind of the companion piece looking at not so much cognitive. Well, he actually was taking cognitive development and applying it more specifically to moral development or ethical development. Are you familiar with Kohlberg by name?
I'm not.
Okay. We'll be talking a little bit more about him later. His name, just for you to know so you can place it, is spelled Kohlberg, Lawrence Kohlberg. He spent his career at Harvard through the 40s through the 60s, from the 40s to the 60s, and had a lot of influence on developmental theory here in the United States. And then Jim Fowler then was I'm not sure about this, but I think that he was rooted in Kohlberg and may have studied with Kohlberg. It's been too many years for me to remember that for sure, but he certainly was within the tradition of Piaget and Kohlberg, and he was taking developmental theory now and applying it to development of one's spiritual or religious development. When I read this material, it's kind of like what you just said, the lights went on for me, because it was the first time that I had read something that provided a really compassionate and really non-judgmental background for me for understanding what was happening very rapidly, which was my departure from a traditional religion. I'd experienced a lot of stigmatizing attitudes from those around me, and I was very confused and puzzled inside with what was going on. And here was somebody, Fowler's work and then Wilber's work later, that was articulating exactly what I was going through and actually gave me an idea where I was headed. I went through a brief phase during this time of moving from kind of mythic traditional religion into rational atheism. I was there in the seminary, and Wilber would later pick up and talk about this in terms of modernism, but very much taken by that. And that period was fairly brief for me. It was probably a year or so in my transition from basically fundamentalism through rational atheism, and then into most of where I've been since then, which I wrote in my notes, I called it Zen postmodernism. Whatever that was about. I began right about that time, began meditating, and that was going on personal for me in terms of my spiritual practice. But this reading and exposure to these ideas really did change me. I should tell you a real quick postscript before moving on. For that particular class, I told you it was called Ecology of Faith Development. I conducted research there was a major research project as part of the class for each student, and I conducted research there. I was living in Pasadena here in Southern California. I conducted research in Pasadena, and then wrote up my research in a lengthy final paper for the class. And believe it or not, or maybe not surprisingly, I was harshly condemned by the professor for what I had written. It was the most critical negative feedback I'd ever received in all of my education, where he said to me in the paper, at the end of it, he said, I think he failed me. It's been a long time since it was so traumatizing. Mm-hmm. And he said, I remember him writing verbatim, he said, we do not need more psychologists like you.
Wow.
It's really,
wow.
Yeah, pretty heavy duty. Victoria, is that you?
Yes, it is. And I apologize. I was late getting on for a whole bunch of reasons, but I'm here now. So I'm very much appreciating this. Thank you.
So glad you're here, Victoria. I'm Bob. I'm very happy to meet you. Really, really
I'm
welcome.
Glad to meet you, Bob.
Yeah. Well, I don't know at what point you came in, but I'll tell you where we are right now, Victoria, is we're just kind of, I'm introducing kind of a personal backdrop to talking about stages of development and integral recovery. And I feel like it's important sometimes to give kind of the personal context for why this stuff is so meaningful to us. And so wherever you landed, that's where we are right now, okay?
Right. Thank you so much. And I actually got in, I think, pretty much in the beginning where you were talking about Kierkegaard. So
good.
I think I'm pretty much tracking. And I agree. It's very, very interesting to hear your own personal journey through the stages.
Yeah. Thank you. I had a philosophy class in graduate school that the professor had trained at Harvard, and the business school at Harvard has this case study approach to studying business and law, and he wrote a textbook on philosophy, and it was a case study approach to teaching philosophy, and he did in that course what we're doing right now, is that, you know, you'd be reading about Socrates or Aristotle, but he'd give you the personal backdrop of their lives, like why these ideas had survival value to them. It wasn't just them spinning out theories, counting angels on the head of a pen, and it really left an impact on me. So while I'm certainly no Socrates or Aristotle, we all have personal lives and contexts, and so that's the rationale, I think, in some ways to kind of situate our conversation today. So I'll pick up where I left off, which is this professor really reamed me. I was going to, you know, like I said, a conservative Christian seminary, so I guess I should have expected it. I certainly wasn't railing against conservative Christianity, but I was writing about developmental theory and its implications for the development of faith and how it actually points beyond, as we'll be seeing here later, it points beyond only traditional approaches, and it certainly isn't about disavowing them, but it can include perhaps transcending and including in the spirit of Ken Wilber, and he would hear nothing of that. Just as some kind of poetic justice, I guess, I went on to present that research paper at a national conference, which gave me some sense of vindication. And I have to say that class, even though it ended kind of negatively for me, you know how that can go in life, it set me on a path. I immediately, for the remainder of graduate school, took every course I could take in developmental theory. In fact, there was a young professor who had just come from Clark University back in Massachusetts, whose specialty was developmental theory, and I took every class that she taught, including a developmental psychopathology course, which was looking at all the various kinds of, I guess, mental illnesses or the afflictions that we bear, looking at them in a developmental scheme, and it really had a big impact on me. Her name was Linda Manns Wagoner, and actually she became the chair for my dissertation and my dissertation ended up being a developmental study of mindfulness meditation. And Linda was my chair, and I was in correspondence with Ken Wilber throughout that process. This was back in the early 80s. He was very supportive of what I was doing, and here we are. Here we are all these years later.
Bob, would you repeat the name of your dissertation again? I didn't quite hear that.
The dissertation was on a developmental study of mindfulness meditation. And let's see if I remember the title of my dissertation. The title of my, you can actually look it up because it's available online at my website. I think it's a PDF file. It's a massive dissertation. I think it's 400 pages long. So caveat emptor. But it's at drbobweathers.com. And if you look it up there, you'll see that it's under, I think, books and articles or something like that. And if you can't find it, Victoria, just write me and I'll send you a link to it. Either case. And I should give you my email address. It's bob@drbobweathers.com. And Dr. Bob Weathers is D-R-B-O-B, Weathers, like the weather outside with an S on the end. And it's just one word. So you're welcome to write me. Both of you always are welcome to write me. Hamlet, our correspondence, and you too, Victoria. So it's a much younger man that wrote that dissertation. No apologies, okay?
Understood.
It had a lot of impact on me. And that was really the beginning of my interest, and it's really continued across my entire career, my interest in developmental psychology, and particularly stage theory. Let me pause for just a second, check in with both of you. Are you okay where we are right now before we dive into kind of some basic foundations? Just want to check in with you.
Absolutely.
Okay. Right. Yes. Fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Good. I'll share for a few more minutes just some basic kind of premises of developmental stage theory. Since you all are familiar with Wilber and integral theory, that some of this may be, maybe all of it will be familiar, but I'm hoping to share it maybe from a different angle since it's more personal here and we're in dialogue. So to begin with, just to kind of get us all on the same page, research like the research that I did all those years ago was certainly preceded by some of the forefathers and mothers that I mentioned earlier. Piaget, Kohlberg, Jim Fowler, certainly Ken Wilber's work was firmly developed, based in structural developmental theory is what it's referred to as. And research psychologists that have studied this have, as you guys know, have identified several different developmental lines of consciousness. And I know that John Dupuy has recently given lectures here on lines, developmental lines, and I'm not going to repeat that right now, other than just to mention some of the major lines that have been picked up, and there's a full-bodied research literature on each one of these developmental lines. The first one that we've already talked about is cognition. And just for shorthand, cognition is what one is aware of. It's like what we're aware of. That's cognition. And it has its own developmental trajectory across the lifespan. There's been a lot of work done on values, what one considers most important. John's going to be lecturing on spiral dynamics in the next week or two, and that'd be an example of examining values from a developmental perspective where there are distinct stages. Self-identity. I was very interested in the early years in the 80s and 90s in developmental approaches to psychology, particularly those that were developed in psychoanalysis. And so you had ended up being involved in a book project looking at infant development, very much based in stage theory. And so you find it in object relations theory. You find it in infant research, looking at across the age span from earliest infancy all the way through the senior years, what one identifies with, how one identifies one's self sense. That would be looking at identity from a developmental perspective. And then finally for now is looking at moral development. And I already mentioned Lawrence Kohlberg earlier. Basically what moral development's looking at is what's the right thing to do? That's the question that's being asked. And we'll go into more detail about this in just a few minutes because it's really kind of central to, it's the particular perspective that I want to focus on today when we're talking about developmental stages. But simply put, ethics or morality is asking what's the right thing to do and how do we come to that decision. Just by way of providing maybe some guidance for all of us, some reminders for all of us. And again, I feel like I'm probably preaching to the choir here. To start with, I'll say these lines of development or lines of consciousness, they really do develop through recognizable stages that are picked up in research cross-culturally. And that's pretty amazing. The research that Piaget was doing on his children in Geneva in the middle part of last century has been replicated across all cultures, both modern and pre-modern cultures. It's pretty amazing. His research was really with his children, and he has been able to be generalized across all populations now. And each one of these stages of development reveals a very different understanding of the world. And we'll be talking about how this manifests in terms of how we make decisions about what's right and wrong. It's just radically different perspectives on that question, depending on what stage or level of development one is at. Having said that, it's really important that we remember that stages are not strict levels like rungs on a ladder. And I've learned this probably best from Ken Wilber, is that, in fact, let me just tell you a story. About 25 years ago, I was invited to teach for a year up at Pacifica Graduate Institute here in Santa Barbara area. You might be familiar or not with Pacifica. It's a Jungian-oriented graduate school that's been affiliated with Joseph Campbell. In fact, while I was teaching there, his entire library was bequeathed to Pacifica. It used to be right next to my office there. It was pretty amazing. And also the work of James Hillman and other Jungian psychologists. They have their libraries there. So I was invited to teach there, and I was invited to start off teaching that year by teaching a course on developmental psychology. I came into class and started talking about stage theory, these various stages or lines of development, cognitive and emotional and interpersonal and moral. And I was stopped cold in my tracks by several students, and they were very uncomfortable with the way I was talking about it. I think I really was teaching it probably more in those days than ever, development as rungs on a ladder. And the way we resolved this, I've talked with John Dupuy about this. He's had a similar experience. The way we resolved this is, if I could talk about development in terms of spirals and cycles, that seemed to work. If I talked about it in terms of lines, forward-moving vectors or lines or rungs of a ladder, then I was just about booted out of the class. And so that was my comeuppance. That was my lesson to be learned about this, that developmental stages are more like loosely defined areas along a spectrum. Let me give you one more example. When I was in graduate school, I studied, had a course on death and dying from Professor Sam Southard, and he was a student of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You all are probably familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross writings, Ross's writings. In fact, it was interesting to me, he always called her Dr. Ross in class. So Dr. Ross has her five so-called stages of death and dying. But what Professor Southard made clear is that he knew her and knew the way that she taught, is that she was very uncomfortable with the way that her stages were taught as being very similar, kind of like these rigid levels or stages of development. She didn't see it that way at all. She really saw them as interpenetrating one another. For her, these stages of death and dying, and I want to apply this to the stages we'll be talking about in just a couple of minutes, they're more like, the term I came up with this week was, they're more like zones of probability. It's like, chances are that at any given time, we may have our center of gravity in one or more stages, but you can kind of locate us that way, but none of us can be defined by just one concrete level or stage. It reminds me of somebody that has worked closely with Ken Wilber's is Bob Keegan. He's a Harvard developmental psychologist. By the way, Harvard is kind of it's kind of a mecca for developmental studies here in the United States, starting with Lawrence Kohlberg, Bob Keegan, a number of major developmentalists, Howard Gardner. They've all taken root there. And so Bob Keegan has this to say about developmental stages and are needing to be careful. He says, I'm quoting him, he says, we are not our stages. That's his first comment. He says, we compose our stages. So we're involved in living out these stages. And then he finishes by saying, and we experience this composing. So you can see what he's doing there is he's wanting to move from some kind of objective pinning people down to a stage to look at how it is that we co-create the stages that we live. That's certainly central to integral life practice, is that we can actually evolve so that we're composing these stages. And the fact is that it's not so much an objective thing about us, is that we actually experience the composing that we're involved in as our lives. I think one side point of this, and I'll pause just to check in here. One of the risks of any map of human experience, and you all know this as well as I, is that we can sometimes far too easily mistake the map for the territory. I've come across this over the years in psychology with the diagnostic manual for so-called mental illness, the DSM. It's now in its fifth edition. And I can remember studying 35 years ago, right when the DSM-3 came out, studying my first abnormal psychology course in graduate school. And there we were memorizing all these categories. And it was very seductive to want to look at everybody, maybe especially myself, as these categories of pathology, to reduce myself or even other people down to this or that pathology. And I learned very early on to resist that temptation, because it certainly is tempting. I trained for about a half a dozen years at the local Jung Institute. And while I was studying Carl Jung's psychology there and applying it to psychotherapy, I studied in depth Jungian typology, which I mentioned earlier. And as useful as that Myers-Briggs typology is, it also can be seductive to where you start looking at people as types rather than as people. It's like looking at people as diagnoses rather than as human beings. And where this leads is that it's very easy to do that with stage theory, whether it's cognitive stages or spiral dynamics, very easy to reduce people down to stages. And I think it's important to name that we really resist that. It's sometimes referred to as psychological reductionism, where you just reduce people down to kind of a single category, and what happens is the person is lost, unfortunately. So I want to be careful as we move on today, talking about developmental stages here in just a minute, specifically moral developmental stages, to resist reducing anybody down to that. We're infinitely more complex, right? So let me open it up. Wow. See what you all think at this point. Any questions you have? Just checking in with you.
I have a question, Bob. When you're referring to, for this topic, to stages, you mentioned spiral dynamics. So we're not talking about stages as in spiral dynamics. We're talking stages as in stages of development within moral and cognitive lines. Because I'm a little bit confused between stages and lines.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good question, and I'm going to tell you what I know by heart. And Victoria, you chime in here. Is lines kind of represent the various content that we're going to focus on? There are different components of consciousness, for example. So thinking is one component of consciousness. Emoting, feeling, is another component. Interpersonal relationships are a component. Hamlet, you're an athlete. You know, your physicality, your athleticism, all that goes into all of that is its own developmental line. According to Howard Gardner, he sometimes summarizes it. There's like 24 different developmental lines. And John Dupuy's work in Integral Recovery has really focused it down on, you know, 4 to 6 developmental lines. They're really infinite developmental lines. But those lines kind of represent the content that we're going to focus on. And so if you can imagine kind of a vertical line, literally, you all have read Integral Recovery, where there'll be like a bar graph with these various lines across them. Howard Gardner developed this idea of multiple intelligences. And each one of those intelligences, whether it's cognitive intelligence or emotional intelligence or spiritual intelligence, each one of those has its own line. And then across that line, there's development across that line, starting from less differentiated or less complex to increased complexity. And that movement across any developmental line is what we're talking about in terms of stages of development. So the developmental line is the content we're going to focus on, and then we're going to look at how that evolves or transforms across a lifetime in terms of stage theory. And when I flesh this out, for example, the example we'll be using is moral development. I think it'll become clear how that we're looking at just one line, the moral line, and how that develops across a lifetime and how that can actually be fairly fluid, especially in and around addiction, since we're talking about recovery here. And just to also respond quickly, Hamlet, Spiral Dynamics, developed by Claire Graves, is really looking at human values. And so that's a specific line of consciousness that he and his followers, Don Beck and so on, have really developed to the nth degree. And so another way to look at that is that what Graves was looking at is worldview development or values development, like how you put the world together in terms of what you value, whether it's survival or humanitarianism. Those are values. And so they do overlap, by the way. Spiral Dynamics, to my mind, overlaps especially with cognitive development, and I would also say moral development, but it includes also a cultural worldview component, and you can look at how cultures evolve. So does that help at all, Hamlet?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it did. It did.
All right. Do you have another question? Is that clear enough for now?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Victoria, checking in with you.
Yes. That was very clarifying. I do appreciate that. I don't have a specific question right now.
That's good. You don't have to have one, but if you have one, as I mentioned earlier, if you have one as we go along, because now we're going to be diving into some content that's a bit maybe more dense, maybe not, feel free to ask a question, and I'll check in with you guys after a few more minutes. So here we go into Lawrence Kohlberg land. This is moral developmental stages. As I said earlier, morality, this is the Bob Weathers definition, studies what's the right thing to do and what makes it so. That's what morality is looking at, studying morality from a psychological perspective. Lawrence Kohlberg broke down moral development into three overarching stages, and then he subdivided those into two stages apiece, and sometimes it gets even more complex. And I'm going to focus on the simplest, just three-stage kind of overview to look at this today, and then my goal is to apply it practically as we go, and with time we'll see how this goes today. I'd like to touch on integral recovery even as I'm discussing, and you'll see this even as I'm discussing Kohlberg, and what we don't get to today in terms of practical applications of integral recovery of morals. Another stage developmental theory. What I'm interested in doing is on Friday during our live discussion forum is to flesh this out some more. So it's kind of an A, B section here. So let's get as far as we can today. And then in terms of application, we'll revisit this on Friday. And hopefully you both can be there. And if not, we'll record that too. So that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to be able to, unfortunately, I will definitely listen to the recording.
Okay, good. And I do what I can to at least introduce a little bit of it. I kind of have different levels of bringing in integral recovery. Here is at the kind of the first level, and I want to look more specifically at practical applications. And then, Hamlet, you and I have discussed this in past conversations. I've developed some material that really almost bears a separate presentation, which is looking at stages of development and the 12-step program. Apply here too. So let's dive in to start with, and Lawrence Kohlberg talked about three basic stages. The first stage he called pre-conventional. And it helps me to think of that in terms of pre-conventional means that this individual is, for short, I'm going to say this individual is at this level, but we have to bear in mind that no individual is at any one level strictly necessarily. We're all kind of evolving, morphing, fluid entities. But at the pre-conventional level, this person has not yet adopted even the conventions of civilized society yet. That's how Kohlberg meant conventional, just conventions, moral conventions, laws, rules, regulations that keep society kind of glued together. At this level, then, the pre-conventional level, is the goal is really to do whatever you must do to stay alive. It reminds me, you all have probably read and are familiar with Abraham Maslow's motivational hierarchy. It's his first level, which is basically about survival. He called it the physiological. It's just staying alive. So the pre-conventional is really, that's its primary focus, is survival. The focus here at this level around moral judgment is basically focusing on whatever it is that makes me happy, whatever gratifies my own needs, and basically regardless of others. And so it's about me. One corollary of this level, the pre-conventional, is to be what you are and do what you want. Regardless of others, follow your own impulses. I mentioned earlier my graduate school professor and who was chair of my dissertation, Linda Manz-Wagoner. Her research focus for her career was on social, what's called social perspective taking. That's associated with another developmental theorist, Robert Salmon. And she would say at this point, and I'm sure taught me this all those years ago, that the pre-conventional morality has an incapacity to take the perspective of others, can't step outside of themselves. In this sense, it's completely egocentric. It's normal for all of us to move through this stage, especially early on. The morality that's associated with this pre-conventional approach to the world is a morality, one author calls it a morality of expediency. All that means is that actions are considered bad only if we get caught. It's whatever's expedient, whatever I can do to get away with it, that's what makes it right. And any rules then are seen as an impingement on my freedom. They threaten my freedom, and so they're to be resisted at all costs. That's the pre-conventional. And as you can already imagine and have read about, I'm sure, the pre-conventional level of morality characterizes for many people their process or experience in and around addiction. Addiction tends to pull people down to this lowest common denominator morally, where if we look at it in terms of addiction in the brain, where the brain is basically hijacked.
Bob, excuse me, you're breaking up a lot for me.
I appreciate you telling me. Thank you. I think there's anything I can do here. Yeah, is it still breaking up?
It seems to be better.
Okay. Okay. You know, I'm sorry about that, but I had some notes, and I wonder if I had the notes sitting on the microphone. I'm gonna.
Okay, that's probably what it was, because it's fine now.
Okay, I'm gonna hold it. I apologize. Thank you for bringing that to me. What I was saying, Victoria, is that this pre-conventional level is oftentimes associated with addiction at its worst, kind of the lowest common denominator, and when the brain is hijacked, especially the reasoning capacities and the moral judgment that's associated with the frontal cortex in the brain, when that's hijacked by especially the pleasure circuitry down in the limbic system and how that connects to the frontal cortex, when the middle part of the brain hijacks the frontal part of the brain, you end up being really, really hamstrung in terms of being able to access anything beyond just survival needs. And this would be pre-conventional morality. The next stage that Kohlberg talked about is the conventional stage of morality. And this is now for the first time where you begin to work on maintaining order through group rules. This is about conforming to the group. In terms of Abraham Maslow, this might be his second and third levels. Here now you're talking about security. And we need to have some rules to govern our behavior, otherwise we don't have really security or safety with one another. And also what he called belongingness, which is now the group assumes priority. It's no longer about me, I, me, mine, as much as it is about us. It's about the group. Wilbur talks about this in terms of this is the stage that represents ethnocentrism. So the move is from ego, I-centrism, to the group or ethnocentrism. And the focus is really on the welfare of the group. It's a social focus. And what goes with this is an us versus them mentality. That's very characteristic of the conventional level of morality. The us are the good and the them are the bad. Here's for the first time where you begin to have an emergence of the ability to see what others are experiencing, feeling, and to respond to that. And so it's the beginnings of social perspective taking. And morality at this level is really based on laws, rules, regulations. It's a very strong sense of shoulds and oughts. And if it's not apparent, this is very characteristic of AA and other 12-step groups. And this is one way of understanding the incredible value of 12 steps, especially for people in first stage recovery, moving out of that egocentrism or the pre-conventional morality to begin to kind of civilize individuals by placing them in a group context where for the first time they begin to rely on the group conscience, as it's called in AA, as well as to begin to take responsibility through step work of the wreckage that they've brought to their various central relationships. So you can see the move from ego to ethnocentrism there. And you also get, and we'll talk more about this when we go more in detail, maybe this Friday, you also get with that a fair bit of the us versus them mentality, including in a lot of the 12-step groups, and we'll flesh that out more. But continue on for just a moment, and I'll check in again with you all. The next stage that Kohlberg talked about, if we talked about the pre-conventional and the conventional, he also posited this what he called a post-conventional stage. And in this stage, what is right in this stage is now based on a sense of equality and dialogue. In other words, there's no longer us versus them. We want to talk. We want to dialogue. We want to engage with others with the goal that every perspective has value. It's not split in black and white anymore. One way to think about this is it's no longer paranoid. And how I mean paranoid here is that egocentrism is paranoid. It's looking out for itself, and anybody that threatens that self is seen as an enemy. That would be the pre-conventional morality, has this kind of paranoid quality. And I'm using this loosely in the way that James Hillman writes about paranoia as opposed to clinical paranoia. But the conventional moral stage itself also has a flavoring of paranoia, and I mentioned it in terms of us against them. It's us that are fine, but it's those people out there that are a threat to us. Again, there's this drawing of boundaries and a vigilance for those that cross the boundary. When you move into the post-conventional morality, for the first time you move beyond paranoia. There's a business author that I read who calls this pronoia. He actually coined a new term. Is as the post-conventional morality moves toward, is inclusive, is embracing, and in this author's words, is pronoid. At this level, post-conventional morality, everyone should have access to sources of self-esteem, ways of feeling good about themselves. And so there really is a goal of moving everybody towards actualizing themselves, becoming who they're meant to be. This really represents Maslow's higher stages of development for sure. And finally here, morality from this perspective, from post-conventional, is based on caring and tolerance. Versus abstract or impersonal rules of conduct. Let me mention one little story here. Lawrence Kohlberg's prize pupil was Carol Gilligan. Are either of you familiar with Carol Gilligan by name?
I'm not.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you'd be familiar with Victoria. In a nutshell, Hamlet, just to cover this real quickly, Kohlberg was studying moral development, going out and interviewing boys and girls, men and women, and came to the conclusion that men seem to be more developed or more evolved morally than women. Boys were more evolved than girls. This obviously was a controversial finding. And as I mentioned, his prize pupil, who herself was a student at Harvard and then went on to teach there and other universities, Carol Gilligan challenged that. She wrote a book called In a Different Voice. It's kind of a classic about this. I highly recommend it for sure. And what she discovered is that it's unfair to kind of gets back to what we were saying earlier. It's unfair to put boys ahead of girls or girls ahead of boys. They just reason differently, for the most part, around ethical decision making. And it comes down to this. Is that what Carol Gilligan, when she went back and reviewed the research, she pushed it a little bit further, because when you study developmental stages, you can't look just at the behavior. You have to ask what was the reasoning that was going on behind it. And what she discovered was this, is that one of the instances she gives is that if an individual, let's say a parent, has a child that's ill, and needs to get medicine for that child, let's say it's a mother that goes to the pharmacy to get medicine and doesn't have the money to pay for the medicine. The pharmacist won't give her the medicine, but her child is in danger of dying without the medicine. And the story goes like this. She later breaks into the pharmacy, gets the medicine to give to her child. And the question is, was that right or wrong? And In studying early boyhood development into adult males, is that males tended more often than not to argue that it was wrong, and that it was wrong based on principles of right and wrong. You don't steal. And girls to women tended to look at it differently, to say, no, there are situations in which stealing could be right, specifically for the sake of relationship, saving the child. And so Carol Gilligan, in her book, In a Different Voice, goes into much more detail about this. But the idea is that here you have, with post-conventional morality, you have a morality that's based on caring over abstract principle. This is why, from the outside, you can look at somebody stealing and you can't judge whether it was moral or not. It may be illegal. You can't judge it as being moral or ethical or not without interviewing the person who is stealing the medicine. And for some people, for sure, who are pre-conventional, they steal, and they're doing it with utter disregard for anything else except for their own immediate gratification. That's very different than what Carol Gilligan discovered with a fair number of her subjects in a preponderance of females, is that they would do the same behavior. They would steal with a completely different rationale. It wasn't about self-gratification. It was about care for their child. So that breaks it out a little bit more, and that gives you an idea of post-conventional morality. Somebody from a conventional perspective will look at any non-conventional morality as being pre-conventional, as being wrong, whereas because they don't have eyes to see that post-conventional morality actually may be a developmentally more complex approach. In fact, it is a more developmentally complex approach to making moral decisions, because the post-conventional person has, in Wilbur's terms, actually transcended and included conventional morality in their decision making. Okay, that's a lot of information. I think what I want to do here is pause, check in with you all, and maybe let's just see where we are right now. We have about 5-10 minutes to go, and we'll take it from there. So, Victoria, Hamlet, is that clear as can be, or do you have any questions?
It's very clear, and it's a fascinating lecture. I hate that we're running out of time, but yeah, I mean, I don't have any questions. It's very clear.
Well, thank you for your kind comments. Appreciate that.
No, it's a lot to absorb.
Yeah.
It's something I'm taking notes, and I'm gonna go back and really integrate it. But it all fits for me. It's very clear material, and has really expanded awareness.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both for your comments. I appreciate that.
Bob, I have another question. These stages, pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional, how does that tie into spiral dynamics and their stages of value?
Yeah, it's a good question. Why don't I attempt to answer this? And what we'll do is we'll wind up today. We have a few minutes here. And what I'll do, and Victoria, I'll mention this to you. I intend, if others are willing on Friday, to maybe do a very brief recap of what we did today,
sure,
or less, and then move into practical applications to integral recovery. And Victoria, I would love for you to review that material and let me know how that goes for you and any questions that arise. I wish that we could all be here for both these. It really deserves a couple of different presentations, and we'll have much more dialogue on Friday. Okay, so let's plan on that. And for now, let me just respond to your question. It's a great question. Here's my understanding, Hamlet and Victoria, is that there's a fair bit of overlap across these developmental lines, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. And so to answer your question, which is where do spiral dynamics stages fit with these pre-conventional, conventional, and post-conventional spots along the spectrum of moral development, where do they fit? And I think it's something like this. As long as we be really careful about this, because you can get people that can be fairly morally developed or fairly inadequately developed in moral development and be very bright or be very athletic or be very musical. And so they tend to cluster together, but there's no guarantee. You can be really smart. In fact, I think, what does Wilbur say? You can be a really smart Nazi. You know, you can be really developed cognitively and morally really, really misguided. So so having said that, let me see if I can take a stab at your question, is that the lower stages of, in terms of developmental complexity, of Clara Graves spiral dynamics, so if you look at pre-conventional morality, it would be those earliest stages. You all can help me with the colors, but it would be beige and red and possibly purple in there. You guys help me with that. What am I forgetting?
I think purple.
Okay. Probably beige, purple, red, somewhere in there. Is that red really typifies egocentric? It's kind of the power, impulsive. That dominates one's behavior, one's view of the world, and one's morality. And so those earlier stages, which are much more about survival, I think of it sometimes as like Viking morality. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. really, for the most part, pre-conventional. And so there would be overlap there. I think it's pretty closely related there, looking at moral development. I just want to be clear that spiral dynamics is not reducible to moral development. I think in some ways it may be inclusive of it. Then if we move up to conventional morality, that's really picked up by the blue in spiral dynamics, by the traditional, the mythic traditional. And John, in his book Integral Recovery, really looks at how the blue is a characteristic also of much of the AA and the 12-step programs in practice, if not in theory. And it makes this point that it's very likely that Bill W., for example, had post-conventional views, for example, the idea of the God of my understanding. that's a post-conventional view in many ways. But in terms of how it's been picked up in practice within AA, it varies. But a lot of it tends to be fairly traditional based, and that would be more typical of conventional morality. And in honor of AA, I have a great deal of respect for AA and the 12-step programs. They can help one evolve from that kind of Viking morality to something that's much more connected to the social group, including one's family and friends and so on. So I think of the conventional really fitting in with the blue of the spiral dynamics. And when you move into the orange, which is the rational, scientific, kind of entrepreneurial perspective and beyond, into green, the pluralistic and so on, you're moving more into what we're talking about here as post-conventional morality. Even with orange, you know, you think of the United States of America and other countries abolish, I'll pick the abolition of slavery or women's rights and so on. That began back in the 1700s, 1800s, and it continued right through the 1960s, where you have a move for looking at universal equality and freedoms, which were really orange in background. Our forefathers were primarily orange, and it continued to evolve through the 1960s into, you know, the various kind of civil rights movements, countercultural movements, and so on that are more green. All of that would represent more post-conventional morality. We didn't get to it today. I will get to it on Friday. There's even something beyond, I think, beyond what Kohlberg talked about, they're really, it sounds a little bit crazy to put it this way, but we probably should talk about post-conventional morality too. Mm. And that moves more into probably with what integral theory. He's talking about the higher stages of integral theory, the yellow, the turquoise, the teal, and all of that. We won't be focusing on that today, but that there's something. Kohlberg really didn't point beyond that. He kind of reaches this post-conventional level, and that's kind of where he made his mark, but there really is post-conventional. You can say the same thing about cognitive development. Piaget stopped at formal operations, but there's been a fair bit of research to suggest that there's post-formal operations or post-abstract thinking. Wilbur calls it vision logic, that there's thinking that is beyond just thinking abstractly. And I think Wilbur's the only person on the planet that does it. Mm-hmm. Does that help at all, Hamlet, as we wind
it
up?
It does, absolutely. Yeah, I was kind of on the right track. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Victoria, checking in with you before. Well,
yeah, and I appreciate that's the question that popped for me as we looked at these three categories and how they relate to spiral dynamics. What is there beyond that?
Yeah.
And you've begun to respond to it, and my guess also is that I don't know.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You get down to kind of 0.001% of the population. It includes probably like Gandhi and Ken Wilber, and I'm just tongue in cheek with saying that. But honestly, you guys, it'd be really fascinating. I started a couple of times in the last couple of years the autobiography of Nelson Mandela. You get inside the head of a Nelson Mandela or a Desmond Tutu or a Gandhi, you get inside and you realize that their morality is not reducible to any of these theories. It's like something beyond that. And I think integral theory points towards that. I think Wilbur in integral spirituality and integral psychology definitely articulates that. But who of us knows that from the inside? Certainly not habitually, like a Nelson Mandela, let's say. So I'm very interested in that with you all, too. So I think it's part of what draws us in this conversation. Are we good? Are we good for now?
Yep.
We are good. I just have to comment that just as you said that last part, there's a kind of excitement that comes up about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, ooh, this is really exciting to be together exploring this.
Yeah, I'm right with you, Victoria. I have to tell you, I get the chills talking about it, too. It's so gratifying to be meeting with a group of people. You know, Hamlet knows this from our meetings, but I really value our time together. And though we won't be able to join together this Friday, Victoria, I really look forward to interacting with you much more in real time through our various conferences and so on. I also want to thank both of you for coming earlier than typical today on a different day to accommodate my schedule. Victoria, I work in a university, and my schedule's not so where I have to squeeze out different times to meet. And so I think every third week or so I'll be presenting like we did today. And I want to thank you guys for your flexibility. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Great. Good work.
Well, blessings to you all. See you on Friday, Hamlet. And we'll have a recording for you, Victoria, from Friday as well, okay?
See you guys Friday.
Thank
Enjoy the rest
so
of the week,
much,
guys.
Bob.
Take very good care.
Take care, everyone.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.